Here this morning. The statement about this meeting this morning is that we were going to have a public hearing on Senate Bill 670 and then an informational meeting with Roy Rue, the director of the Department of Forestry, answering questions that came up during some very long hearings. And so with that, I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 670. Judith Reed, to catch line, would you please?
Certainly. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 670 prohibits certain persons from importing animals from the state of Hawaii, the United States territories, and possessions or foreign countries on behalf of an animal shelter. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. And with that, I'm going to close a hearing on Senate Bill 670, and we're going to open an informational meeting. And let me make this clear. What I have done in my thinking after 2 days of hearings on two bills, Senate Bill 430 and Senate Bill 689, is as questions come up, I am inviting various entities back to talk more. And several people had a lot of questions. Several people on the panel had a lot of questions for Roy Wu, and so that's why we've invited him this morning. We might be inviting other people, whether it's from the coalition or the counties or industry or whoever. Whenever the questions come up, I'll invite people back to give me their answers or to respond. We're going to have a busy agenda, although it wouldn't look like it right now because everything is kind of clogged up and we don't have anything on the agenda. And with that, I ought to say that we will not have a hearing on Monday morning because there's nothing on the agenda. So I hope somebody passes that word on to Senator Corcoran. He showed up for a hearing once before when we didn't have one. And with that, Roy, would you come forward? I understand you'd like to make a statement or two, and then we'll open it up for questions.
Chair Shields and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Roy Wu, acting state forester, and I will be having three other of my staff to join me as we make our presentation and answer questions. But I would like to, before we get into the more technical part of our conversation, want to just take a brief moment to review with the committee the context of the Northwest Forest Plan. And I truly believe that our management plan is in between the two bookends of these House bills, 699 and 430. There are documents and minutes of board meetings in the late 30s and early 40s that suggest that the uses of these lands, Board of Forestry lands, do consider other uses, and that also, as the board in the late 1990s embarked on a forest management plan, adopted a greatest permanent value rule as an administrative rule, and in those rules really set in detail about how the board and department would move forward with the present Northwest Forest Management Plan. And I would suggest that the plan, as the board directed the department, is a plan that looks into the future and how to create the opportunities for the future in terms of our delivery of goods and services. Also, it's an approach of what we call integrated management or multi-resource. The state of Oregon in the past few decades have evolved into three major approaches in terms of forestry: reserve, wood production, and multi-resource or integrated. As we look at the reserve model, which you'll see predominantly in the federal forest lands, its benefits are high in environmental and low relatively in social and economic. As you look at the model of wood production, if you are an industrial forest, it is high in economic benefits and low or moderate to the social benefits that model provides. We look at, on the other hand, the state forests employing a diverse or a multi-resource approach will produce a moderate to high level of social, economic, and environmental benefits. And I would like to refer you to a set of graphs in the back of the handouts that you have, And I'd just like to quickly go over the graphs and try to conclude with the point that I'm trying to make.
What page is the graph?
It would be at the back of the stapled packet with the cover letter on it, the last two pages in that.
Okay, there's three pages altogether?
Correct.
Okay.
Okay, these graphs depict in a relative sense which alternative management approach provides the array of forest resource outputs. So as you look at these graphs, look on the left-hand side of them, entitled Contributions Provided Under, and then what I like to then show is under the financial efficiency model, you'll see that if you look at, relatively speaking, that approach provides high outcome or contribution to timber volume, employment, value added, if you will, the economic outcomes. The other contributions are, if you will, relatively moderate in that approach. Why, if you look at the next page, it talks about then what we refer to as the reserve-based approach, that the contribution there is high in terms of environmental benefits, as I was referring to, and you can see the specific items that are listed, you can see that the social and economic are relatively moderate to low. While you look at the contributions provided under an integrated management approach, it is basically and as I described earlier, in between the bookends of a reserve base and a, if you will, an industrial-based management approach. So I would like to conclude by saying, as we move into the information that my staff will provide as we move forward, that it is a matter of degree in which way we move within these goalposts, and that the board, if you will, have provided us direction in the forest management plan as we implement the plans, that we work within this integrated approach that provides an array over time, over landscape, of a variety of goods and services, both social, economic, and environmental. So with that, I would entertain any questions or comments, and we'll move forward with the rest of the hearing.
I have lots of questions, but I don't know whether at what point I should begin asking questions or let you make a few more presentations. And I know that Senator Beyer had indicated he had some questions for you too. I don't know if anybody else does or not.
I have a couple.
Do you want to ask questions now?
Yeah, mine are the most simplistic probably. So
okay.
And I've been asked to ask these questions by a constituent, Mr. Wu. His first question is, why is it that there are 840 miles of logging roads on the Clatsop, State Forest? Is it Clatsop State Forest?
Yeah.
It is? Okay. That didn't sound right to me. Why is it that there are 840 miles of logging roads on the Clatsop State Forest roads that dump a lot of sediment into streams and salmon spawning areas, and there's only 1 mile of non-motorized recreational trail in the forest?
Senator Coughlin and Chair Shields and committee, in our presentation that will follow, we will specifically address those two questions.
Okay.
Okay.
Second question, Mr. Chair. How is spending $38,700,000 on 774 miles of new sediment dumping roads in the Tillamook Crane Forest achieving the greatest permanent value from the state forest for all Oregonians? Exactly what human services, including education, should be cut to support subsidized road building in the state forest? See if you can get Mr. Wu to give you some specifics.
We will. Okay. And we will.
Okay.
Chair Shields and Senator Corkland. And
I love doing consistent work.
We will provide answers to those questions.
Okay. Well, let's
see. That was easy.
That was easy. Let's continue. And if, whether you want to deal with those now or later, or some of mine now or later, is up to you. Let's. See, where had you planned to go next here?
Chair Shields, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ross Holloway, and I'm the director of the State Forest Program for the Department of Forestry. And let me first lay out where we intend to go and tell you when we'll address those specific questions that Senator Corcoran raised. You have in the packet before you a wealth of information. Specifically, we intend to briefly present information on three key questions or topics that flowed out of the last two hearings. One would be recreation management on state forests, and I'll lead off with that. Then we'll move to the socioeconomic analyses that have been prepared by the department in the past, as well as some questions about the more recent socioeconomic work done by the Tillamook Crane Forest Coalition. And then third, the third topic is how forest management activities affect water quality and fish habitat, and that would be the topic where we'll address the roads issue, Senator Corcoran, and what we're doing in that regard. In addition to those topics, we did include a couple of other pieces of information in the package you have before you today. One was a summary of the planning process that we used to develop the forest management plan, since there were many questions in the testimony about inclusiveness or what exactly we did in developing the plan. So that document is in the packet that you have. And we included a copy of our Swiss Needle Cast strategic plan for state forests, the latest update of that, since that seemed to be key to a number of issues that were raised in terms of how we manage the state forests. So with that as a context for where we're headed this morning, I'll go ahead and start out with the discussion of recreation management on state forests in Northwest Oregon. And in your packet, the stapled one with the cover letter, the first document behind the cover letter titled Recreation Management on Northwest Oregon State Forests is a summary, and I'm just going to merely highlight some of the things that are in that document as I go through this. I've been involved in the development and implementation of the department's recreation management plans since their inception, the modern day plans in 1991. So I thought I'd give just a very brief history of how the recreation program has developed and then talk about our current management program. Recreational use of state forests dates back a number of years. In fact, modern day use developed following the burns and while the rehabilitation effort was underway on the Tillamook. So this is in the 1940s. And actually, one of the early strategies in the rehabilitation program was to fireproof that forest so we would not see a repeat of the Tillamook fires at a scale that we saw in the 30s and 40s. And one of those strategies was to develop fire-safe recreation areas that people recognized at the time folks were going to recreate in the forest due to its location near Portland and other large population areas. So a series of campgrounds was actually established starting in the 1940s. These campgrounds were all located down close to the rivers and streams and basically moister, more fire-safe areas so that people wouldn't just go out and camp wherever they chose. Now, some still do, but primarily the camping takes place down near the rivers. So a total of 11 parks were established through that program. So that really was the start of sort of a organized recreation management program in the forests. With the recession of the early 80s and the decline in timber revenues, which is what we use to manage the forest, that program was essentially eliminated. So the parks were still there, but they became unmanaged in large sense. I mean, we picked up the trash, but we didn't have a management presence in those parks. And that turned into quite a problem over the years as the use persisted in those facilities. In 1991, the legislature passed House Bill 2501, which directed the Department of Forestry and the Parks and Recreation Department to work together to develop a comprehensive recreation management plan for the Tillamook. I think two key things in that bill. One, it talked about that plan being consistent with the primary purpose of timber production and with the statutory mandates for the management of the lands. But it also directed us to develop recreation management, forest interpretation, and forest education programs and efforts. And the Tillamook Recreation Plan was developed over an 18-month period. We used a public advisory committee. I was a member of the team that developed the plan. And the final plan was adopted by both the Board of Forestry and the Parks and Recreation Commission in January of 1993. So this planning process really established kind of the template for later planning efforts that we used on the Clatsop and the Santiam. And it laid the foundation for the recreation program that we have today. And the recreation program has two primary components. And one is staffing in an Oregon Department of Forestry staff to establish a management presence and effectively deal with the recreational use on these lands. And it is a high level of use on the Tillamook. And the second part of the program is really, it focuses on development and maintenance of facilities for both the existing use that's been ongoing and also some anticipated increases in use that we see and I think we'll continue to see. So following the adoption of the Tillamook plan, we started to have recreation staff in the agency again and are basically built that staff over the years in implementing the Tillamook plan, expanded because of the Clatsop and Santiam plans that were prepared later. And today we have on the north coast for us, it's on the Clatsop, we have 10 full-time people that work on recreation management. And that ranges from district recreation coordinators to assistants. We have an off-highway vehicle coordinator just because that level of use is so high in that particular group. And we have a number of projects and activities going on, and one of the attachments in your material is a summary of the action plan items for the current biennium and the next biennium for the Tillamook and Clatsop Recreation Action Plan. So you can see some of the specific things that we're doing. And those action plans were developed with a public advisory committee process about 2 years ago for the Tillamook. We updated it for the Clatsop and the Santiam. We created the first ones. So currently, our current fiscal budgets, personnel, and projects total about $1.3 million for the Clatsop and the Tillamook, and that's just one fiscal year. And the total positions, as I said, is 10 for recreation management, and we have another over five additional FTE for the interpretive and education programs that we're implementing on the Tillamook. And that's about another $400,000 in our fiscal budgets. So in total, I mean, these budgeted resources represent about 11.5% of the total operating budget that we have for the Clatsop and the Tillamook, and I think I included the Santiam too, although it's much smaller, or about 6.5% of our total program-wide operating budget for state forests. And that's just for fiscal year 2003. That's probably going to increase in 2004 because of the Clatsop and Santiam plans are just now really hitting the ground in terms of projects. To address the question from Senator Corcoran, who's left the room, maybe I should wait till he returns.
Maybe we'll wait till he returns, but my question as I was listening to that is that the picture you paint, unless I'm missing something, is that the condition's quite a bit different than Senator Ringo when he was describing driving out and not being able to find a place to park and not having any place to hike and so on and so forth. Have you had a conversation with him and shared this information with him?
Chair Shields, as a member of the committee, that is our plan, and we just need to schedule that with Senator Ringo and have that conversation with him. We've also offered to also take him out in the forest and actually go through the plan with him on the ground and show him what we have in terms of our planning for 10 years and what we're going to do on an annual basis for the next 2 years.
Okay. Chair, Senator Beyer also has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In the hearing, I heard over and over again from the proponents of the Senator Ringo's bill, whichever one, I don't remember which number that was of the two bills, but the managed use, logging, you know, those areas are mutually exclusive from recreation. You can't do both in the same area. That was their contention. That was the theme they kept bringing, that you got to set aside parts of the forest to be used for recreation because you can't recreate in areas that are being managed. I would like to know if, in your, what you see out there on the ground, if that's true. Do people use areas that are managed for recreation, or are the two mutually exclusive?
Chair Shields, Senator Beyer, and members of the committee, in developing the Tillamook Recreation Plan, we clearly looked at that and set about trying to integrate uses out in the forest. I would say largely they are compatible. There are specific uses that are more and less tolerant of other uses and activities. And obviously remote hiking opportunities, most people don't want to encounter a logging operation or some other activity. But many of the other uses, off-highway vehicle use, is very compatible, goes on in the same areas. We sometimes close portions of trails because of a thinning activity going on, but we reopen them after the management is done, and we have several examples of where that's happened. So I think in large part the uses are compatible with some specific uses from time to time where you do need some separation.
Mr. Chair, follow up.
Go ahead.
Thank you. When you have closed the trail for a short period of time, do a thinning operation or something like that, and then reopened it afterwards, have you received complaints from people who have then walked on the trail and said that this no longer meets our wilderness experience because you've managed the forest there, or has that been a problem?
Chair Shields, Senator Beyer, I'm not aware of any specific complaints. I imagine there probably have been some from time to time, and those come into our district offices, but it hasn't been a... Generally, we notice that ahead of time, and people are aware, and we have a public advisory committee that we work with on the Tillamook with a variety of interests represented, and we work with that group ahead of time to schedule those kinds of things, so the general user community knows and agrees ahead of time with that type of scheduling and closures.
Chair Shields and Senator Byers and committee, if you would refer back to what I said earlier about our integrated use and look at those bar charts, refer to the expectation of an integrated forest. The expectations of an integrated forest, it is a working forest, active management will occur, and I'll speak from my experience when I worked in Northwest Oregon area on a forest grove and actually observed various recreation advisory committees to us. Generally, there's that recognition acceptance that this is a working forest and that the so-called wilderness experience is not that expectation in the Tillamook Forest, because we are an integrated forest and we will be doing other activities. Having said that, I think as Ross may go into, there is a lot of people that use that forest and enjoy the forest for what it is. And I think that's important to note. Also, in the projection of use for recreation use on our forest, we employed a advisory group that is made up of not just users, but also folks from OSU, Recreation, and also Park Service, and help us determine what our niche was in a working force in providing an array of recreation benefits. So I think it's important to always come back to that context of this forest and its use, and that we are providing a range of uses, not going from one end to the other, if you will, on the spectrum.
You might want to pick up with Senator Corcoran's, since he's back here now.
I was just going to ask Chair Shields and Senator Corcoran, members of the committee, to address your question on the miles of non-motorized trail in the Clatsop State Forest. We don't have much non-motorized trail in the Clatsop, and there are several reasons for that. I think first of which, historically, the Clatsop Forest has not seen the kind of recreational demand, at least in terms of that type of use, as the Tillamook did. And frankly, our priority earlier on in our recreation program efforts focused on the Tillamook because of the legislation that directed the planning for that forest, and because that was where the heaviest use occurred. Clatsop has seen heavy use from a lot of other recreational uses, hunting, angling, and those sorts of things. The second thing I would say is the recreation plan for the Clatsop, which was prepared in 2000 and finished in 2001, includes an action plan, a 10-year action plan for projects and activities, and we're just starting with the implementation of that plan. And I would have to, I actually have a copy of that plan with me that I can leave with the committee. But in there lays out what the specific development efforts are in terms of campgrounds, trails, and other types of facilities and infrastructure for recreation. So the short answer is it hasn't been a priority, and it's becoming one, and we're going to start developing more opportunities on the Clatsop.
Thanks.
If I might, I'll close with my recreation management portion. Okay. Let me see where I left off. So I was talking about the staffing and expenditures for the coming fiscal year and the coming biennium are, we do expect to increase as we continue to implement the Tillamook Recreation Action Plan. And again, as I stated, as we really move into full implementation of the Clatsop and Sandy Am Recreation Action Plans. So just by way of summary, really the modern day recreation management program on these North Coast forests is really rooted in the Tillamook recreation planning efforts in the early 90s and has been evolving and expanding over the past 10 years. There's plenty of projects and priorities still to be accomplished. And, of course, these 10-year action plans, we've just really started into them on all those forest lands. I guess with that, I'll just wrap it up and see if there's any more questions about the recreation management program aspects before we move on to other topics.
Okay. I don't have any more of those recreational questions, at least not now.
Okay. Chair Shields and committee, at this point, I'd like to have Gary Lettman come up and join us and address the economic analysis pieces, and which recreation will come back up again.
Okay.
As Senator Shields, committee, my name is Gary Lettman. I work for the Resources Planning Program of the Department of Forestry. What I'd like to do is start out with a little bit of background about how we got to where we are. In 1994, I met with then state economist Paul Warner, Rebecca Johnson, professor of recreation at Oregon State University, and Hans Rodke, who's a fisheries economist. And we sat down and discussed that there would be a new state forest planning coming up for the Northwest Oregon State Forest. And what we didn't want to do was get to the end of the planning process and then say, well, we need an economic analysis to validate what we did. What we wanted to do were three things. First of all, we wanted to generate discussion about the Northwest State Forest place in state and local economies, and we want to provide information to interested parties prior to forest planning efforts, and three, we wanted to save the taxpayers money by relying on volunteers to do the analysis. And we ended up with a team of 13 people. We had a recreation specialist, a recreation economist and professor at OSU, two fish and wildlife economists, the state economist, state senior economist, state demographer, and the state economist Paul Warner was kind of the lead and figure out where we go on this. And then to get a regional flavor, to talk about what was happening to these individual communities, we put on a team, six regional economists from the employment division. I think we pretty much met our goals here. We had two printings of the document, and we generated much discussion with economists and the general public, and the document does seem to fulfill its purposes. The first conclusion we came up with was that, and it's documented in the report, that, and we gave this to the state management program, that the Oregon State Forests are also expected to provide recreation, clean water, and healthy populations of fish and wildlife for residents of burgeoning metropolitan areas and tourists alike. What was limiting in our analysis was how to handle non-market values, preservation values, for example. You know, how do you value wilderness's value for future generations? There's a lot of controversy on that. What we did was we took values from other studies across the country and tried to relate this to what was happening in the Northwest. And indeed, we came up with these values were very important and made a recommendation that those values should play a significant role in determining the future management of the forest. Now, we also came to the conclusion that timber management and other uses were not exclusively competitive. when many times they can be joint or complementary production functions. One of the purported benefits of structure-based management that's being used in the plan is the ability to create high-quality fish and wildlife habitat and other non-market values, while at the same time providing timber and other products that can be sold to enhance local and state economies, while also providing revenues to counties, school, and, importantly, state government. The idea is that more and better ecological and amenity values can be provided faster with active management targeted at improving forest structure than if the planted stands are set aside unmanaged to follow their current path. And much of the scientific community has concerns that the existing stands, if left unmanaged, may develop attributes that duplicate the natural old-growth forests that were developed previously at low densities. These are planted stands. There's Swiss needle calves involved in them, and they will need management to get to where you need to go. The timber harvest revenues and related economic benefits that have already been forsaken to achieve structure-based management goals should not be overlooked. These are the opportunity costs, and they've been substantial. And one of the premises of structure-based management is that by giving up these economic benefits, Oregonians could achieve many of the desired environmental and amenity benefits. I'll give you some numbers. Timber harvest. In the long run, structure-based management, instead of maximizing non-declining production of wood volume, results in a long-run annual harvest decline of approximately 151 million board feet from the 493 million biologically sustainable harvest potential. That 493 does have some minimal environmental protections, so you lose 151 million there. And this does not include additional set-asides that would result from district implementation plans. Setting aside an additional one-half of the forest in addition to that would result in an additional 171 million board foot harvest decline and additional operational fall downs. Long-term harvests would decline to about one-third of their potential, not including operational fall downs. And operational fall downs have always happened, and we've seen them go from $1 billion, for example, in Northwest forest plans and BLM plans to $173 million, which was last year's harvest. I do the harvest report. In the short term, those are long-term losses. In the short term, losses would also be substantial. Using an industrial short rotation wood maximization scenario with few environmental protections, they meet state forest practices rules, for example, and a few more, harvests would be about $370 million in the next decade, and I did the harvest scheduling on this, versus a proposed level of $175 million in ODF proposed implementation plans versus $112.6 million proposed by the supporters of Senate Bill 430. And that Senate Bill 430 likely, again, overstates probable harvest because of additional harvest fall downs resulting from implementation of the bill's planning. Under Senate Bill 430, the proposed harvest would be about 70% lower than the non-declining harvest potential in the next decade. Okay, let's look at revenues. In the fiscal year 2002, that's the last year for which we have complete data, 175.3 million board feet of timber were harvested from the Clatsop and Tillamook State's forests. This is approximately the harvest from the implementation plans that the districts for these forests project. Even with the current decade low stumpage prices, these harvests generated $59,200,000 for common school fund, counties, school, and other local governments, reforestation bond payment, the state general fund as an offset to school funding, ODF for forest management and protection, and for special products or for special projects such as road improvements. The decline in timber harvest revenue for not harvesting at the biologically sustainable potential is already about $65,700,000 per year. The additional cost of harvesting at 112.6 million board feet instead of 175.3 million would be about $21,200,000 per year. Total annual fall downs in revenue distributions from potential levels would be approximately $86,900,000. The cost would increase dramatically in future decades as expanding potential harvest levels, operational fall downs from implementing district plans, and rising stumpage prices increase the difference between the potential and the actual revenues. The revenues, and how important are these revenues? Well, the revenues distributed from state forests, this is just an example, are extremely important to state and local economies. For example, 24% of Clatsop County's general fund in fiscal year 2002 came from Board of Forestry timber harvest, as did 27% of Tillamook County's revenues, general fund revenues. Okay, we can look at economic impacts, and this is more complicated because the economy is multidimensional, and there's all kinds of different cuts at it, different ways you can do it. There's controversy about all the different ways, and I've been told that there's two things you really don't want to see. Number one is sausage making, and number two is making economic forecasts, and both of them leave a lot to be desired in how firm the data is that you're dealing with. However, we were able to get consensus among the group that was working on it, and taking a look at recreation first, from our survey, and we surveyed the recreation that was going on in the forest to get an idea of how important it was for people, what the value was, and what the economic impacts would be to state and local economies. Okay, the biggest impact from recreation economically is the value, net economic value to the users themselves. That is far outweighs the value that it provides to the state and local economies. And these values came per trip. It was averaged $128.11, with hunters paying a lot or have valued a lot more at $162.19 per trip. Both these amounts were greater, again, than the personal incomes generated in local regional economies per trip. However, current recreation activity adds few and mostly low-wage jobs to local economies. A relatively few number of higher-paying jobs will be created, but they occur mostly in the Portland metropolitan area, which is the area's regional trade center. Different recreation activities than are already occurring on the forest could have different economic impacts, but I haven't seen specific proposals for alternative recreation industries that have been offered, and there's no locally derived quantitative evidence that the proposed forest management plan would not be compatible with many of the uses that might be proposed. Okay, we can look at then versus timber versus recreation, and they both have values, and I believe that many times they are complementary or joint productions, not competitive. Senator Shields.
Okay, let me... I've been wading through this stuff, trying to understand it. I hope everything you've been sharing is part of the written report.
And a lot more.
But it seems to me that, you know, when you harvest timber, the benefit is clear and quick and easily measurable. So many board feet, so many dollars to the county, so many dollars to the state general fund. When somebody goes for a trip into the forest, whether it's $128.11 per trip or $151 or $191, you had your figures, I have different figures.
Right.
That's much harder to measure, number one.
Right.
And number two, how much the state benefits or how much the local government benefits is harder to calculate. And number three, I'm not hearing what the local shop owner gets out of it, or the local hotel, motel owner, or restaurateur, or whoever, you know?
We do have that information.
Well, okay, that's good, but my point is that there's one way to get money into the system much faster than the other way.
Right.
You know, there's a comment from one of the many reports I've read that said that tourist spending is responsible for about 65,000 jobs and generated $1.1 billion in earnings and contributed $58 million to local taxes. But, you know, that's much harder to measure and figure out and to know how much less it would be if the forest were managed a different way, if this were a less appealing environment for tourists. You know, you don't know what the point is that it's going to fall off. You don't know what an enhancement would do. You don't know how much it'll go up if you increase this recreational part that you were talking about. And so I see counties, I see school districts, I see the state saying, over here, this is hard to calculate. It's long range. Over here, this is as quick as cutting down a tree, and so it becomes kind of a non-contest, if you know what I mean. How do you address that?
Well, we address it in several different ways. First of all, we look at the quality of the economic activity that's generated by... Well, first of all, you have to look at, you know, like Ross was talking about and I'm talking about, are these productions joint, competitive, or complementary? And in some cases, obviously they're joint or complementary. In some cases, they may not be. Okay, so if you have a motorized use in the forest, they're probably joint or complementary. So you don't have a trade-off there. In other cases, you would. So then you can look at the types of job you have. The average wage of the job in 2003 created by timber harvesting is $32,000 per year. The average wage created by recreation is $18,000 a year. There's just a difference in the quality of economic activity. There's a difference in where the activity occurs. Often the timber harvesting activity will occur in the local communities, loggers or whatever else are out there. Many of the high-wage jobs will occur in Portland from this. There will be some high-wage jobs from recreation, but they will occur in the regional trade centers, which will be the Portland areas. So there are lots of different ways we can look at it. We can run it through our econometric or input-output models to give you all kinds of information. But what we cannot tell you is what the exact production functions are or trade-offs are between these activities.
The formula just gets too complicated.
Yeah, we don't have the information.
And that's partly why we grilled Roy Wu yesterday for a couple hours in the Natural Resources Subcommittee about yet another issue that we haven't gotten to yet. Okay. You want to continue, or where are we going now?
Sure, I've just got a couple more points I would like to make. And the final point is that in addition to the uncertainty you're talking about in the trade-offs between the production functions, there's also an uncertainty about unintended consequences resulting from changes to forest management. I previously mentioned that these are just a couple examples that much of the scientific community has concerns that the existing stands, if left unmanaged, may never develop the attributes that you're trying to get to. So you'd lose not only on the economic end of it, but you'd also lose on the amenity end of it because these stands wouldn't be where you want them to be. Second example I'd like to, and this is that the small woodland owners will very likely oppose this set-aside to keep non-industrial forest land from being converted to other uses because of poor financial returns from forest management, and to keep rotations relatively long on non-industrial lands for environmental benefits. Viable markets for large logs need to be maintained. And this means that a significant portion of future timber harvests must consist of large logs, with federal harvests having declined to almost nothing, and with forest industry owners harvesting their timber between 45 and 50 years of age on average, it is important that the state forests contribute as much as possible in the future to the large log market. Not doing so could have adverse environmental and economic consequences, and I think these are some of the things that you have to look at in addition to the immediate dollars or the recreation uses. There are all kinds of unintended things and consequences that could occur from these changes.
Yeah, such as the guy the other day in the other hearing that was cutting his logs way up high because if you cut them down at the usual stump level, they were too big for any existing sawmill.
Right.
Right. Okay.
And with that, I'll conclude and take any questions if you have any.
Any questions right now?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure if we're at the right person yet to answer the questions, but I do have some questions about the numbers of on the Dave Ivanhoff presented different scenarios and cost analysis at the first hearing. And I think some of those questions have been answered in this report that you've given. One was, what is the volume of the Tillamook or of these two forests? I mean, we had his guesses were between 9 and 13 billion board feet. I would hope that someone in the department has a better estimate than that, or more accurate, defining in that range.
Let me take that.
Yeah.
Chair Shields, Senator Beyer, members of the committee. That range was created based on two data collection efforts, or two efforts. The 13 billion board foot estimate of the standing inventory, I believe that was on the Tillamook and Clatsop combined, was based on our old forest inventory, which we had grown forward for a number of years, and not kept up adequately, frankly, because of the new planning process and the development of a new inventory system. The 9 billion board foot estimate was calculated based on a permanent plot inventory that we put in place and measured in 1999, and actually the data outputs from that came to us late in 2000, early 2001. And that really is the core of the concerns over what is the inventory out there and what is the appropriate harvest level to flow from that inventory right now. And the evidence suggested at the time that the bulk of the fall down from $13 billion to $9 billion came from Swiss needle cast growth losses that simply weren't part of the inventory grow forward because we had no idea what the magnitude of those losses were. And it was that permanent plot inventory that first clued us into what was going on in terms of growth losses from the past. I mean, we knew currently trees were growing less because of Swiss needle cast infection, but we hadn't really been able to calculate the magnitude of what we already lost. There were some other contributors to the fall down, including the growth and yield models used to grow those stands forward were probably overgrowing some of them. So that really, though, was the core then of what became an issue of concern in working with the counties on the harvest levels. What was projected as harvest levels in the modeling that Dr. John Sessions did versus what we were seeing as we worked from the ground up and produced the implementation plans. And the two did not meet, and I think Mr. Ivanoff's numbers go through that. What's the potential of a healthy forest, which clearly is in the 350 million board feet per year plus range, versus what's out there now and what's growing now? And that is yet an unanswered question in the bigger scheme of things. We have a new forest inventory. We're in the second project year, and that's bringing data in that we're going to use to improve the harvest schedule model and the growth and yield models so that we have more accurate numbers.
Mr. Chair, is the short answer to a long answer that you do not know, you don't have a better estimate than between 9 and 13 billion board feet?
Chair Shields and Senator Beyer, that is correct. Right now we don't. We're getting the data to nail that down.
Okay, Mr. Chair, any questions?
Go ahead.
The document that we just provided and referenced says that sustainable yield harvest potential is 493 million board feet. That's higher than what even Dave Ivanhoff came up with under his, because his high number was 438 million board feet at 13 billion board feet. So somehow, I mean, that's a fairly significant difference. I mean, we're talking at least a 10% difference between those two numbers. I would say that Mr. Ivanhoff used some very low growth rate numbers and some very high discounting to say 4.5% growth rate on a Class 1 forest, and then still discounting that by 25% because of Swiss needle cast. That is extremely low growth rates for a Class 1 forest, in my opinion anyway. So your own document that says a $493 million biologically sustainable harvest potential would indicate to me that there is closer to 13 billion board feet than 9 billion board feet out there, and that it is growing at what I would consider higher rates than the 4.5% per year discounted by 25%. And is that, am I missing a number someplace, or can you fill in the gaps for me?
Well, Chair Shields, Senator Beyer, and members of the committee, I'll ask maybe Gary to elaborate on where that number came from. But of the three numbers, I would say that one, that's the oldest number. That was generated in, what, 1994 or 1995 when they did their socioeconomic work. And I can't, Gary can probably talk to what land base maybe was used to generate that number, whether it was the full 530,000 acres or whether that was reduced for some of the constraints that those later numbers reflect. And Gary, do you want to
actually
on that?
The lower number for the current decade is stuff that I'd done in my harvest scheduling using forest inventory and analysis plots, completely independent of their analysis. The second number actually came from some of John Sessions' work, which took the highest possible biological potential off the runs, and it hadn't been discounted. I guess there's some additional discounts, perhaps for Swiss needle cast and stuff like that, but that was the very highest run, which was close to the biological potential, we figured. And you run out to board foot per acre, and it comes out pretty reasonable, you know, what you'd expect from high-site land. So.
Okay. Another question, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Obviously, I just got this document today. These questions all may be answered in this document. But the original plan, you know, called for the 279 million board feet harvest. So that was the original proposal. I asked last meeting what the harvest was in '02. That wasn't answerable at that point in time, but I think this says it was 175 million board feet. So with that, we're still 100 million board feet below what your own model says is what you should be doing for the structure-based management level. So do you, are your plans to step up to that 275 roughly million board feet level in order to implement your own plans?
Chair Shields, Senator Beyer, members of the committee, I think that potential is there. The $279 million board foot number was a number generated from the inventory before we discovered the Swiss needle cast growth fall downs. In other words, if you believe there's 13 billion board feet of standing inventory out there, then that's a good number. If you believe there's 9 billion board feet of standing inventory out there, it's not. But I think, you know, as we work through the process of converting those severely infected Swiss needle cast stands, which we are currently doing, the growth is going to increase on those acres because we're replacing stands. The stands in the coastal strip in the severe zone right now, the estimates are 60 to 70% less growth than would normally occur in a healthy stand, not the 30%. That's an average across the landscape. But where we're working right now is in stands that have almost stopped growing entirely in terms of the Douglas fir there. So I think that potential is there, but I think we have to move upwards into it at a conservative pace as we find out more and update our inventory.
And just as 13 billion as a base gives you one number and 9 billion gives you another, and the Swiss needle cast also affects the number, doesn't the habitat conservation plan, which you haven't really implemented yet, also affect that number rather greatly?
Chair Shields, members of the committee, the model runs we did, that Dr. Sessions did, and the various alternatives that he looked at, the model run and the number that Senator Beyer referred to anticipated the habitat conservation plan strategies. In other words, that model run reflected what we thought would need to be in place for an HCT for owls, murrelets, and salmonids.
So you're
that number's already adjusted for that. Now, we don't have a habitat conservation plan, which actually constrains achieving that full harvest level.
Wait a minute. I didn't understand what you said.
The original model run that Senator Beyer referred to that projected 279 million board feet per year reflected our anticipated habitat conservation plan strategies, what we believe we would need to have in place to get the incidental take permit for owls, murrelets, and salmonids. The reality today is we don't have that HCP and that incidental take permit, and that constrains the opportunities because we're practicing.
I guess what I'm saying is, how can you anticipate it before you get it in place? Are there things that you may not see? Are there bumps in the road that may occur between your projection of what you think you might get when you have a habitat conservation plan in place and really getting it in place? And this is what I listened to a lot of this stuff kind of in a state of confusion yesterday afternoon and the previous afternoon, but that wasn't my hearing. So if I didn't catch it then, elucidate, enlighten me now, would you?
Well, Chair Shields, members of the committee, we've been working on habitat conservation plan strategies for 6 years and working directly with the services, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, for a long time. The draft strategies have been published, gone through scientific review, public review. I think they're not going to change a lot more, frankly. We do need to make a final submittal. If we do decide to proceed with the Habitat Conservation Plan, which is the Board of Forestry's decision. But I think when we did the modeling in year 2000, we had already developed, in conjunction with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the core strategies that would constitute a Habitat Conservation Plan for spotted owls, murrelets, and salmonids. And it really hasn't changed significantly since then in terms of the technical strategies.
Yeah, I still want to follow another question, okay, and then we'll get back. And because I want to stick with this habitat conservation piece a minute. If you run into things that you haven't anticipated, are there any potentials that some of the compromises, even some of those that are suggested in Senate Bill 430, might help you to get to a conservation plan that would really insulate you from the suits that you might end up, you know, under the Endangered Species Act? Is there, you know, I'm just, as Roy knows, I've been trying to get people to compromise with each other ever since I first heard about this. So I'm just throwing that out there.
Chair Shields and members of the committee, yeah, I've been trying to do that for 9 years on this plan, so it's a long history with it. Are there unanticipated issues that could arise before the HCP is finished? Yeah, I suppose there is a possibility, although we have been engaged in this for a number of years and had input from all sides as we've moved through it. So that to the extent that there's a substantive issue out there related to one of these species that we haven't encountered, I think the chances are pretty slim, but it's possible. And that the National Environmental Policy Act review, that's really the test. Is there something substantive that you haven't considered and addressed and just overlooked, basically? And if something like that appears, yeah, we'd be back talking about it. Other HCPs that have been developed for multi-species, that hasn't been a common occurrence. I mean, they've submitted them. There have been some minor adjustments, and they've approved.
Okay. I had one final question, and it doesn't have to do with the Habitat Conservation Plan, but goes back to the earlier questions of recreation. And it just occurred to me when I was asking all my other questions. And that is, when you talk about recreation, you talk a lot about the revenue that the Department of Forestry earns, you know, whether it's through campground fees or, you know, sales or whatever. Do you think there's more room for study of the value of recreation for coastal businesses? Do you think you've got enough input? I just remember somebody being in my office saying, you know, they were a coastal business person, don't think that we've been brought into the equation very much. And so I know that we had those statistics about the jobs, and you said $18,000 a year jobs versus $32,000 a year right. Jobs. I'm just trying to reflect what I heard from that person.
Well, I think if somebody proposes a different type of recreation that's going to put more money into the economy, that's not a big deal to analyze. The problem is coming forward with a specific proposal on what somebody wants to do. Now, there was a proposal several years ago that they wanted to develop destination resorts on the Tillamook Forest, and we could easily run something like that through a model to give you exactly what and where this stuff would occur.
Okay. Senator Beyer had more questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. While you're on the Department of Conservation plans, can someone tell me or explain, I mean, I just heard today about the Salmon Anchor Plan or the Salmon Acre Program or something that's starting going on. What is that and where is it going, I guess? I just need light over there.
Sure, I'll cover that. Okay. Chair Shields, Senator Beyer, we're referring to our Salmon Anchor Habitat Strategy. And I'll do the best to give a short sort of history, where it came from, how we got there. Prior to finishing work on the forest management plan, we had two different reviews took place. One, an independent scientific review, which was a review of the core management plan strategies as well as some draft habitat conservation plan strategies that were that had been developed at the time. And in that review, issues were raised about habitat for salmonids and the need to protect core habitat areas to a greater extent than perhaps the general landscape. And the context of it with the reviewers was, as they put it at the time, was hedging your bet. The larger management approach for the landscape, which was structure-based management combined with a set of aquatic and riparian strategies, I think generally received favorable reviews with the caveat that we ought to have some areas where we're managing with Salmonid habitat as more of a focus, if you will, or managing risk there in the short term in a way that maintained those areas or assured maintenance of those populations. It really harkened back to the original core area concept that ODFW had developed earlier. Concurrent with that, we had a proposal made by a group of organizations, Oregon Trout, Wild Salmon Center, and EcoTrust, for a specific salmon anchor habitat strategy for those North Coast forests. So that was on the table. We also had the independent multidisciplinary science team appointed under the Oregon plan by Governor Kitzhaber working on forest-related issues. They weighed in on our plan, largely endorsing the approach we were applying, but also pointed out that they felt there was a need for a strategy to address these core areas, basically population hotspots or habitat hotspots for salmonids. So with all that in the mix, the board, when they adopted the plan, included direction in that plan for us to develop an anchor habitat strategy for salmonids. And that is what we set about doing, and that is the what you're referring to that we just finalized and are putting in place. And it's essentially identification of a set of basins on the North Coast that were identified as having either the highest populations or the best habitat conditions for key runs of salmonids. And we're implementing just a different approach to managing in there. We're managing in those basins, sometimes very actively managing in those basins, because they overlay with the Swiss Needle Cast zone heavily, as you would imagine, the coastal strip. Coho and Swiss Needle Cast, they're in the same basins, basically. So the core strategies in there are, one, to manage activities in there. It's a one-decade strategy, essentially. I would call it an adaptive management strategy in that sense, as we're doing things differently in those basins and monitoring and trying to learn for a period of time. And then we'll either adjust or the strategy will sunset, or I don't know what will happen in 10 years. I hope we know a lot more about salmonids and their habitat in 10 years than we know now. But that's kind of the nutshell version, and I'm sure I'd be glad to answer any follow-up questions. You may have more.
Mr. Chair, is this something that's in addition to the entire plan for the Tillamook and the five-foot forest? Or was this anticipated and built into the plan?
I believe it was built into the plan.
Chair Shields, Senator Byer, it was anticipated when the board adopted the plan. When you say built in, it's an additional strategy overlay that we were working on then and have now finished working on in how we manage in those basins.
But as you were developing it, it was anticipated.
It was anticipated. It's alluded to or spelled out in the forest management plan that there will be a salmon anchor habitat strategy, just like there's a strategy for Alzheimer lets.
Chair Shields and members of the committee, the board, when they adopted the plan, had a set of findings and a set of intent statements for the department as we implemented the plan. And I believe item 12 of the intent statement under watershed assessment, it pointed in there the intent of an anchor habitat strategy or something like that. And I want to also add on in anchor habitat that in our agreement in building this strategy with ODF&W and Oregon Trout, that we are committed to maintaining our harvest level at the high-end implementation plan, and which met in order to negotiate where those anchor habitats were, that our harvest level would not be affected. And in fact, we've done that by, as Ross mentioned, we are planning on actively managing those basins just in a different way and perhaps at a different intensity level. But really, the we have other basins. Not all the basins are under an anchor habitat. And so those other basins are available for us to, if you will, to meet that harvest objective. I also want to take this opportunity to talk about the HCP, and I'll take a crack at, you know, our strategies that we've chosen in our forest management plan goes back to the greatest permanent values, goes back to those intent statements and findings of the board as we implement the plan. We believe that in framing up the the process for the for HCP or not. It is strictly a business reason for us as we think about it. The strategies that we have are anticipation of the greatest permanent value for those lands, and also for the impacts of a take avoidance strategy, particularly in a Santiam State Forest and in the forest in Western Lane and also in West Oregon. So what we're trying to do is implement a plan that meets the greatest permanent values. There's a whole array of things, and anticipate the long term of an ESA, a long term of, if you will, try to anticipate what, as we strategies, as we do structural based management, the reality is we're going to be building habitat for these creatures, and we need it appears that we need an HCP to be able to have a take permit as we have this larger habitat type. That is the strategy that we built into the current management plan. I would ask Ross if there's further clarification of what I just said. I would welcome that.
That's fine. I'll just answer any questions.
Eric. Senator Boyer.
One more, I guess. I wanted to get some contact on this salmon acre habitat strategy, because the numbers that were provided to us about economics, I mean, they, unless there is an error in your numbers that you just gave us, and if you want to grab these documents back up and refigure your numbers before you actually give them to us, because I'm going to be using these numbers as what the Department of Forestry says is doable and sustainable and their plan points to. So if these are wrong, please let us know. But this, codifies the 279 million board feet. I think if I did the math here real quick, your own plan is talking about 276. So, I mean, we're a little bit off here. And you just said the acre habitat strategy was included in those figures, so that should not reduce harvest levels anymore. I mean, the quickest way or the surest way to reduce harvest levels, you got two ways, but the most permanent way is to take land or reduce your land base. If you reduce your land base, that is what's reducing your harvest levels. So if you're not... if you're saying with all these habitat conservation plans and anchor habitat strategies and anything else, and that's all been figured into this, and your own numbers say that's 279 million board feet or 276 million board feet, and we're not achieving that, then either there's been some vast miscalculation or you've taken more land out of the land base and for your reasons for not getting there. We need to know what it is, because those are the ways you change your own process. So I guess, obviously, I haven't read the whole document. We just got it today. But if you're doing that, we need to know about it.
Chair Shields, a member of the committee, we will do that and get back to you. Also, I think it's important to note in the implementation plans that I approved in March that there is a chapter in that plan that specifically states that we will work with the counties in terms of maturing the harvest modeling, the growth and yield tables, if you will, and the inventory Ross is referring to see if our numbers and our projection are, if you will, projected in a correct and accurate way. So we know that, as Ross mentioned, that we have some inventory issues and modeling issues, and that we're, and in recognition of that, this work plan will help us address that with the counties and the county's forestry consultant.
Roy. Maybe I'm over my head in information. Certainly I'm over my head when it comes to understanding something that you guys spend 6 to 10 years working on, and we have 6 to 10 hours, to try and figure it out. But it looks like, from all sides, you get to be the one that has a target painted on front of you and on the back of you and on both sides of you, and you get shot at and missed from every angle, and sometimes shot at and hit. I won't change the old cliche there. This sounds crazy, but I'm going to say it out loud anyway. I've heard real complaints about, you know, your plan, and one of our good colleagues went out last weekend with some of your folks and looked at a cut and saw the 600 cubic feet per acre laying on the ground, and people in the industry come back and say, you know, we're trying to be good environmentalists, and we have a forest management plan, and our plan calls us to do just 20 cubic feet per acre, and if we're not good environmentalists, tell us why we're not. And so, you know, you're criticized from that angle. You're criticized from the other angle, and Senator Beyer has been quoting from a section in here that he's using the $493 million sustainable harvest number, and actually that part of in the same paragraph you talk about how much essentially 430 would reduce that. So you're getting hit from both sides.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I understand what you mean about long term and highest permanent value, and you want to leave all of that wood in the ground to decay, and 600 cubic feet per acre seems to be the minimum. But what if, I mean, do you have enough science? Maybe it was the multidisciplinary team that came up with that science. I don't know who did. But is there any way to find compromise that could take, and this is just a wild, okay, discounted, it's just a crazy guy from the city talking, okay? But what if part of 430, there'll be no comments from the metropolis of Cottage Grove, please.
I live 6.5 miles southeast of Cottage Grove in the foothills of the beautiful Cascades, thank you. 0.5 mile from my nearest neighbor for very good reason.
Yeah.
Their choice.
And we keep trying to figure out how to run this committee with you about a half a mile. We keep trying to figure out how to run this committee with you 0.5 mile away, too, you know.
Is this a bill that we heard in 95?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think you could talk to get handcuffs on.
I'm going to handcuff myself.
I want to correct the record.
Okay. So it sounds crazy. What if you tried less than this 600 cubic feet per acre, which would up yield at one level, but took that savings there and that productivity there and translated it into more habitat preservation elsewhere, as some of the suggestions of 430 might. I realize I have a very incomplete picture, but I think you get my drift. Would you like to swing at that for a while? No, you're never going to make anybody happy. You still have your... I'd watch your back if I were you, because there's a target back there and there's all kinds of people behind you. You know, from both sides. So, you know.
Chair Shields and members of the committee, boy, do I know that. Someone sat next to me yesterday in that hearing and said, why is it so hot over here? And they figured it was because they were sitting next to me, were members of the staff. But I would say that Ross would like to clarify a point, and then I would like to address your idea.
Okay.
Chair Shields, members of the committee. I would like to clarify. I think there's a lot of misinformation out there about that particular target you referred to. The 600 to 900 cubic feet of downed wood target is not a retention target when we do a harvest operation. It's part of the definition of older forest structure, which is our oldest, most complex standpipe that we are trying to develop out there on the landscape. The particular quantity came from the Society of American Foresters' definition of old growth, and we looked at that definition and said, what are the characteristics of these older stands? What is it that we need to create if we want to emulate that? And there were a number of things. Size of the largest trees was one, number of snags was another, and amount of downed wood was a third. And I think indisputably it's a habitat element for a lot of species. So we're not required to leave 600 cubic feet of downed material when we do a clear-cut or regeneration harvest. In fact, there's a specific retention target, and I don't have it at the tip of my tongue, but it's like sound logs 24 inches and so long, it doesn't add up to 600 cubic feet, I don't believe. But the goal is, down the road, when that large stand develops, that kind of large wood will be there. Some of it will be there from wind throw. Some of it will be there from mortality for other reasons. Some of it may very well be there from past stands that were on the site prior to our management. So I just wanted to clarify that. But the number is based in science and in the accepted definitions of those older stand conditions in the literature.
I wish I'd had a chance to go with Senator Dukes last week and see it myself, but I didn't. So I'm still trying to visualize this and what it looks like in my head.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Fisher, he was going to answer the other half of my crazy question. So as soon as he's done with that, we'll have your question. Is that okay?
Chair Shields and member of the committee, in thinking about our conversation the other day, Chair Shields, about a compromise, and then subsequently conversation with my staff, and also a conversation with the Chair of Board of Forestry last night, I would say or characterize the answer, the short answer, and then I want to put a lot of other qualifiers to it behind it, is that, I think there are policy pieces in our plan that we can look at and review as, what opportunities are there to look at for adjustment. And I put it in the context of the economy that we have in the state of Oregon right now. I mean, it's and I'll speak for myself, but, we understand the interests and the pressure from the state of Oregon in terms of the economic situation. I've had a good conversation with Senator Dukes last Friday about the situation and Representative Morgan and others about the dilemma that the state is in. So in order for me and the board chair to think about this, it is a matter of what are those policy pieces do we have embedded in the plan. And it has to go back to, again, to the board's finding and intent statements. And looking at that is maybe where we can look at in terms of, quote-unquote, a compromise. Now, having said that, there are fundamental principles that we built our plan around and subsequently how we implement. Those plans are, if you will, those principles are the foundations of the policy, the very policy conversation or the policy pieces that, if you will, that we've had a conversation in the last 2 days in the Ways and Means Committee and we're having now. Those principles and those policy pieces have to come up in terms of what's for example, what could be out there for quote-unquote compromise. I would be willing to work with our board chair, who I talked to last night, and have a conversation with this committee and others about that subject. It's a guarded yes, because it is the principles that we are concerned with that we must hold dear in how we built this plan. And we, meaning the board of forestry, the department, and all the other stakeholders in the last 6 years and perhaps longer as we move forward to now. But having said that, we certainly appreciate and understand the economic situation. If there's opportunities we can do, we'll do that. But it's going to be has to be done carefully, thoughtfully, that we don't end up in 2 years from now wondering how in the heck did we get to this point.
And thank you. I know that it's a big complicated issue, and I know exactly what you mean with a qualified yes. But the stakes are high, because if you don't get at something, you're going to have lawsuits, or you're going to have ballot measures. You're going to have a lot of money that I don't think needs to be expended when we're in the middle of a recession or depression or whatever we're in. Mm-hmm. When various sides start fighting over whether you've done enough or whether you've done too much. And like I said, you still have a target on your back. And so it's tough.
Senator Shields and member of the committee, I agree. But also there's a point that I want to bring up, and that is, you know, when the board and the department struggle through what this plan should look like, in terms of looking at those three approaches, it did go back to the administrative rules, and those administrative rules inform us in terms of what the parameter plan should be. But also that we involve the public, and I don't mean just the interest groups, but we involve the publics either in surveys or in other forums. And I am concerned that if we do something different, and I'm not saying that we are, but we can talk about it, that we honor, if you will, that commitment and those principles that we have in the plan to date. So
yeah.
I just want to just share that and be on the record.
Okay. I want to give Senator Fisher a chance. He had a question. He's been waiting several minutes now.
That's all right. We had a long discussion in here and hearing on a bill that would have locked up half of this area. I now understand the governor's making a trip over there that very near future, possibly this next weekend or this weekend, to somewhere or another lock up 155,000 acres. How do these programs fit in? Are they going to, all these anchor habitats and stuff like that, are they going to come out of the what's left of one half after the governor's taken 155,000 acres and everybody else is clawed over it?
I'll go ahead and take a shot at that. Chair Shields, Senator Fisher, members of the committee, what you're referring to is the Salmon Anchor Habitat Strategy, and I believe the governor is going there tomorrow to the Tillamook to look at that. And my earlier response to Senator Byers' question, those are the basins where we are applying different management, but they're not set asides. They're very, very active management in several of those basins in the Swiss Needle Cast Zone. We're just managing in a different way in there for a 10-year period. So they're not reserves, they're not set asides, and I want to have that on the record. I'd be glad to provide the details of the strategy to the committee that Roy approved in the implementation plans last month.
Mr. Chair,
thank you.
Point of clarification, you say the 155,000 is a salmon anchor habitat?
Senator Fisher, that's correct.
I just did a quick add up, and there's 229,000 on the 409 on the salmon anchor habitat.
Well, Chair Shields, I'll have to look at those numbers and reconcile that.
You could have a conversation with them and add up numbers after a while. More questions? We've kind of beat ourselves to death. If you want to make a few closing comments.
Chair Shields and members of the committee, we did have Ted Lawrenson plan to address the water quality and fish.
Okay, I'd like to do that for a few minutes.
Okay, we can do that
while
quickly.
He's coming up, let me make a comment, and he can slip into a chair. And that is, I appreciate you coming back, and I appreciate everybody's interest. And most people should know by now my desire for some kind of compromise in the whole thing. In a week or so, I would like to try to get you guys back here to talk about another issue, which has to do with forest legacy. Senator Messerly and Representative Morgan gave me a set of questions which you've been working on. It looks like you're making good progress towards some pretty comprehensive answers to those questions. As soon as your response is finalized and you've got your I's crossed and or T's crossed and your I's dotted.
You've got my eyes crossed.
Sorry about that.
Better joke.
Okay. I screwed up. Let me say that rather than us ending up with a document that we haven't seen before in our hands, could you get us those answers to those questions somewhat in the format that I think you're developing right now, so that Beyer and I and even the good senator from Cottage Grove might have a chance to read it before we come into committee. Would that be okay?
Yes, definitely.
Okay. Thank you. Ted?
Chair Shields, members of the committee, my name is Ted Lawrence, and I'm Assistant State Forester in the Policy Division. I think we want to segue a bit to some of the direct questions on the roads that were asked earlier, because it's a water quality issue. I think Ross has information specific to that before I get to my more general comments, if that'll work.
Yes, all I have to do is fight it. Thank you. Chair Shields and Senator Corcoran, members of the committee, in relation to your earlier question on the roads, and I believe he asked the question, why 774 miles of new road at a cost of $38 million? I looked at our district implementation plans when I saw that number, and to see where it came from, because we do publish those plans, and those are specific plans for each of the districts under our Northwest Oregon State Forest Management Plan, and in there they project their anticipated annual road construction, road improvement, and road closure numbers. And I assume this number refers to the Tillamook and the Clatsop State Forests. And what I found when I looked at those implementation plans, and this is combined numbers for the Tillamook and Clatsop, projected 26 miles per year of new construction. So that'd be 260 miles for a decade. Now these are estimates that we project in there based on accessing management activities like thinnings or clear-cut harvests, or sometimes other activities, but that's the primary reason for the road construction. So 26 miles per year of road construction, 92 miles per year improvement of existing roads, which could be anything from an old road that's largely unused to a current road. It just needs some work to upgrade it and improve it. And 12 miles per year of closure of existing roads. So those are roads no longer needed. A lot of them are old roads that were put in places that we now, you know, don't want them. So what I came up with was 260 miles of new road construction in the 10-year period, 120 miles of existing roads closed for a net gain of 140 miles of roads. So 774 miles of new roads, somebody else's calculation of the numbers from our implementation plans. And I can't speak to how it was calculated. The roads, again, primarily are for access for forest management activities. Of course, they also provide access for fire protection and public use. And from what I know of the implementation plans and the activities, they're predominantly the spur roads, the short ridgetop roads. The main road networks are in those forests and have been for a number of years. Some of those will probably be closed following use. Others will not, I'm sure. They'll be left open for other uses or subsequent management. So that's what I was able to derive looking at the implementation plans. And I think Ted can reflect some on roads and sediment and water quality when he does his. But if there's any follow-up on that, I'd be glad to.
Any questions? Thank you for putting that in the record.
Just doing what I'm told.
Yep.
Chair Shields, members of the committee, again, I'm Ted Lawrence, Department of Forestry. There is in your packet of material a brief summary of forest practices, water quality, and fish, and as attachments to that, there's a report from Adams and Territute on domestic water use in Oregon.
Have I got the wrong thing, or is this the brief thing that
you were No, there's a briefer thing in your packet. Thank God. Okay. But that's one of the two attachments.
Part of this one. Okay.
The attachment you lifted up with the spiral bindings are sufficiency analysis we just completed with DEQ, which looks at how well do the Forest Practice Act meet water quality standards. Just generally, in terms of what's known, forests very clearly yield very high quality water, the highest of any land use in the state. Looking at water quality as a broad topic, it's important to consider the trends, and very clearly using DEQ data, the trends in water quality are very positive and affirmative. And one of the reasons why that is recognized in the State of the Environment report is that practices on forest land are so good. So that's just kind of a general overview in terms of water quality. Words are important, and our economists talked about forest practices and standards and use the term minimal. I want to be clear that the forest practices protections are substantial, and It's an interesting point because I think public expectations for forest lands have been always much higher than for other land uses, and because of that, forest practices on Oregon's forest lands are world class. We can certainly document that. And that applies to all issues in terms of outputs on forest lands. For example, we require 2 snags per acre be retained for wildlife purposes or green trees. I don't see similar requirements for ag or urban lands. One, there's the same fundamental reason to require those in all land uses, but we've chosen to do it on forest lands. So I think it's an important context that there are substantial protections. Public expectations are very high, and the outputs off of forest land in terms of water quality and fish and wildlife are also substantial and very high. Second important context is that disturbance is both inevitable and essential, and that provides the context for fish and wildlife and water quality. The fundamental premise I think you've heard people argue is that we need protections that will preserve forests for water quality protection. That's not based upon good science. You can't preserve forests. They will have disturbance, and in fact, ultimately that disturbance is important for environmental health. But it's also fair to say that fish and water use are the dominant factors in developing our best management practices that apply to forest land. It's also important to talk about the layers of protection on forest land. We have the land use program, which fundamentally for forest land conserves it, and that's the basic first step of protection. That's a huge step that many states don't have, and that's an important thing to understand. States of Washington and California are losing forest land at a very rapid rate compared to Oregon. Second level of protection is the Forest Practices Act, which is designed to provide for water quality standard maintenance on forest lands, and it does that. We monitor that, and that's what the sufficiency report gets to and documents that. It also provides for the overall maintenance of fish and wildlife, and again, we have monitoring in place to look at how well that's achieving that end, and again, on a landscape basis, we're doing very well, and the trends for fish would argue that that's the case, and I do have some specific data in terms of fish impacts from other activities such as harvesting that, you know, people are going to debate forever about the dominant causes of the fish problems, but it is very clear on some areas that forest lands are not a key factor in fish issues, that over harvesting of fish and other factors were. We've addressed those, and now the trends are clearly very positive on coho in particular, and would argue that the habitat must be there on forest lands or the fish wouldn't be coming back the way they are. As I said, fish and water use are the
down... Are you saying that that is or isn't a supportable response?
It is a supportable response. My opinion, and I'll state as an opinion, is that there is abundant habitat on forest land. The changes in fish management practices have resulted in a rather rapid response in coho recovery, and obviously if the habitat wasn't there, that wouldn't have been the case. The ratio of recovery has been beyond people's expectations in most cases. So,
What do you say to the people that say that it has nothing to do with that, but has more to do with ocean conditions and stuff like that?
I would agree the ocean conditions are a factor in recovery, but fundamentally, if you don't have the hotel rooms of habitat, you're not going to produce it when they go out to graze in the ocean. So, okay. And there's other analysis that would argue that there's more than adequate habitat to maintain coho on forest lands, and it is improving. And that's the issue, or the trends. And very clearly, habitat trends, water quality trends are all positive. It's also important to point out that we have developed these rules through collaborative processes over a 30-year period. And as a sidebar to that, we developed with the Board of Forestry a good set of rules. We have adaptive management cycle to do that. Collaboration has never led to full consensus and agreement that the rules are adequate. We do have the monitoring in place, and we have a very good record of being able to document if there are problems and then making changes. And again, I think we've gotten down to the point where we can say with a fairly high degree of certainty that the forest practices rules are very substantial and addressed all the key issues that we're aware of in meaningful ways. Domestic water use is also a consumptive use, and that can be at odds with fish and wildlife purposes. And it's important to understand that there's some irony there. The policy in the Forest Practices Act gives preference to fish and wildlife needs as opposed to domestic use needs. And that's an important thing to keep in mind. But just a general summary in terms of what the Adams and Territute literature review that you provided talks about in terms of domestic use, and the key conclusion, forest practices can have a range of possible impacts, insignificant, positive, negative, and combined effects that vary greatly. They're influenced by specific location, treatments, and duration. But the bottom line is that while activities such as road building can have an impact, with best management practice now in standard uses, temporary changes in flow of sediment nutrients usually cannot be distinguished from natural variation from year to year. And that's the bottom line. And that's what we're trying to achieve, and we're there. Some of the myths that people describe is the concept that there's pure H2O that can be provided by forest lands, and that's not true in any circumstance. In pristine forests, as people might view it, we see outputs of water ranging from sediment levels in a single basin ranging from 0 to 2,000 parts per million, which is chocolate milk, and that's from the Flint Creek watershed, which is basically unmanaged control. So that's the natural range, and what we're finding is that our managed basins are within that natural range as well. Another concern that we heard expressed is the notion that management will somehow change water yield. And actually, ironically, trees consume water, and in most cases, forests actually reduce water yield over a clear cut. But again, that's not neither nor bad nor good, but there's a sense that people articulate is that we need to protect forests so we don't reduce water yield. Well, that's not consistent with any known facts out in the scientific world. Forests do not, timber harvesting does not decrease water yield. The final point I'd make is that management's very important to keep forests in a healthy condition that helps them withstand the impacts of the inevitable disturbance that's going to occur. And it's fair to say that at this point in time, as the document talks about, there are as many watershed managers now as concerned about how do we manage for disturbance as they are about any other factor. The city of Ashland is looking at how do we get in there and deal with our fuels we got on our watershed to avoid that catastrophic fire, and that management is the solution to that. So it's important to understand that disturbance is inevitable and that forest management is a key tool in maintaining the forest health that makes that disturbance less of an impact. And with that, I'll close and answer any questions.
What are there questions?
I have a question about Swiss needlecast. One of your strategies for dealing with it is to actively manage the areas where it's found and replace the Doug fir with other species that either were or are indigenous. And I guess my question is, do we know in those specific areas where the Swiss needlecast is the worst, whether those were, I don't know how you can say originally, but in the past couple of hundred years, was Doug fir the predominant species there, or was it the red cedar and some of the others?
Chair Shields, Senator Corcoran, and members of the committee, the zone in which Swiss needlecast is most severe is the coastal fog belt, basically from the beach in 6 to 10 miles, depending on the topography. That is the spruce hemlock zone on the coast, and is commonly described that way. Douglas fir was a native species to that zone, but probably in percentages in the 10 to 20% range. A lot of the reforestation work we did, and others in the 50s and 60s and beyond, replaced those species largely with Douglas fir, and then favored it through pre-commercial thinning and other activities. So I think the sort of the conventional wisdom amongst our forest pathologists is that we overstocked that zone with Douglas fir. Native disease now has a lot of the host around where it didn't previously, and it just built up to a level that's...
So we essentially kind of created the problem.
We exacerbated
it, I think, through the species changes that took place there through management. And there were some weather factors that contributed, and then once it built up, I think, it just moved into stands farther inland, frankly. So,
thanks. I was curious reading your report, and just I wondered what, you know, what the behavior was that, because I thought Doug fir was typically monoculture, but I guess it's not. That's more by design than by nature.
Ted, I'm going to thank you for your report, too. We've heard from all of you, and unless there's more questions, I'm going to adjourn pretty quick, but I do want to say that a lot of people wanted a chance today to contribute their perspective to your perspective. And rather than open that door, which could mean we'd sit here till 3 o'clock, going in, we had a decision that this would be a chance just to hear from you. I expect input to come my way from lots of different sources. After this meeting, I'll share the results of that with you or whatever. We may have another chance to go at this publicly. Depends on our schedule. But I do want to thank you for today. And I want to thank all of you who so attentively listened. And I just keep hoping that we'll learn something along here. Somewhere, somehow, maybe there'll be an epiphany and we'll figure it out.
Thank you.
Just to help my friend from Cottage Grove, before he spends a lot of money trying to cure his cross-eyedness, he ought to check with a veterinarian. They have a very cheap way of doing it.
Yeah, okay. Even though you're being so kind to me, Senator Fisher, I'm going to announce one more time that there will be no meeting on Monday. You can work on your taxes. Our next meeting will be April 16th, Wednesday.
Senator Fisher once again proves that
we're adjourned.